Okay, so this is about 2:41, and it is September 2nd, Tuesday, right after a long Labor Day weekend. That was really, really nice. Let's see if I have any announcements. I think I fixed all the quizzes so that you can see your wrong answer on the quizzes, so you can go back and look up in the book what the correct answer is. And I did not fix some of those links. There's still some links in the weekly exercises, the weekly assignments that I have to fix. So I am still working on that. And then I have a question for you. Who still is not logging into Blackboard because of a password problem or something like that? Raise your hand if you cannot get in. Do I see anybody? Do I see anybody? Everybody can get in? Okay, I had a bunch of emails over the weekend to fix passwords, and I think I got to everybody. Maybe I missed one person. I'm just double checking. But anyway, if you sent me an email, I didn't get back to you, then please resend the email to me. All right, so that is good because we should have worked that out last week, as a matter of fact. All right, so let's look at the schedule, and we see that on the right-hand side. I'm going to turn one more light off. I'm going to turn this one off. All right, so don't forget the URL. This semester is different than the Blackboard URL that we were using last semester. So indeed, today is the 2nd, and we've got 2 lectures in chemistry left. Oh, good. I thought we only had 1. That's excellent. Yeah, 2. Thank goodness. So don't forget to start doing some of your pre-lecture reading assignments. That will make lecture a whole lot more satisfying to you. And your first exam is 1, 2, 3 weeks away. Is that right? 1, 2, 3 weeks away. So it's going to be on these chapters, 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right. Does anybody have a question on the schedule? Yeah.
For the exam 1 for study guide, can you just follow the book for it, or should we follow your lectures?
Probably my lectures, but in the study guide, it tells you what pages in the textbook are important. So not every single page, but whatever page I have. I think I have that in Blackboard too, the pages. And it's not always continuous. Sometimes I jump around from the beginning of the chapter to the end, right? And sometimes not all the way to the end. So just look at those page numbers. And then as far as end of chapter questions, not every question. Sometimes it might be every question, but whatever in the study guide. So if somebody has a question, what's going to be on the lecture exam? My answer is always going to be study guide. And you can get the study guide with your textbook, and you also can get study guides in Blackboard as well. Okay. Yeah. All right. So any questions on what we were doing last time? What's one thing that we looked at last time that's in this nice table form? What is this thing right here? Anybody know what this is on the right-hand side? Yeah, periodic table. All right, so you do have to know the names of some of these chemical symbols. You do have to know the atomic number. And who knows what atomic number means? What is? Yeah, number of protons inside the nucleus. And if we change the number of protons inside the nucleus, what are we changing? The element, yeah, the chemical, the element. So we're changing silver to gold or carbon to gold or something like that, which we can't really do. Right. But nature can do that, and so nature's come up with all of these different elements that have a different number of protons. Also, you should know, where do protons exist within an atom? In the nucleus. What else do you find in the nucleus? What else do you find in the nucleus? Okay, inside the nucleus. I tell you what, how many different areas are there to an atom? In terms of this class, how many areas are there? 1, 2, 3, 2. Yeah. What's one area? Nucleus. And what's the second area? The orbitals or shells. Yeah, orbitals or shells. That's the only two places. So subatomic particles have to exist in one of those two places. And you were really good. You told me, where does a proton exist? In the nucleus. Right. And what's another particle? Oh, but a particle. What's another particle besides a proton? Neutron. Ah, good. Where does a neutron exist? Where do we find neutrons? In the nucleus. And give me the third particle. Electron. Where do we find electrons?
In the shell.
Yeah, in the shells, the orbitals around the nucleus. Yeah, that's fantastic. So in terms of our class, we're interested in chemistry. Chemistry is a result of those electrons in shells, and in particular, the very outermost shell. And that outermost shell, because it participates in chemical reactions, it's got a special name. What's the special name for the outermost shell? Yeah, it's a valence shell, right? Because that's where electrons can come and go. What's a good way of thinking of a covalent bond? Sharing electrons. What about an ionic bond? Transfer. Oh, that's good. I didn't say that last time, but I like that. Transfer of electrons from one atom to another. They're not going to be shared. All right. And which one is stronger in biology, ionic or covalent? Yeah, covalent. Very good. In other kinds of chemistry where water is not involved, then sometimes ionic bonds are much stronger than covalent. But since all of these things we're talking about is dissolved in water because we're made up of water, then covalent bonds are much stronger as a result of that. Okay, how many protons does phosphorus have? That's just a quick little quiz for you guys. Yeah, it says right there. And there we go. So the chemical symbol for phosphorus is P, and there's that big 15 staring at you right there. So that's really easy. So you'll be able to whip through these questions on the test really, really nice, as long as you know what these different elements are. Okay, so I'll probably give you the English word, and then you got to translate it into the symbol, and then use that chart. This chart is also handy because it tells you something about the orbitals of those electrons. So in the first shell, how many electrons can we put in the first shell? Yeah, and you can see that by looking at this first row. How many electrons can go in the second shell? And you see that it has eight elements in the second row. So here again is a nice cheat sheet for you that you'll have during the test. Okay. So we were talking about water last time. We drew it out. Actually, we formed that water molecule where we made covalent bonds. And if we look at the water molecule from far away, it does not have any electrical charge. It is neutral. But when we get close to it, that changes. What happens as we get close to the water molecule? What do we notice? That one end, yeah, one end is different than the other. Right? So here is an oxygen, here are the two hydrogens, and you all know that water is H2O. H2 means two hydrogens, one oxygen. These hydrogen ends over here are a bit more positive. The oxygen end is a little bit negative, so it has polarity. It has a difference in charge as we move across the molecule. So depending on how you walk up upon this molecule, it might look a little positive or it might look a little negative. And since it has these electrical charges, it has some kind of attractiveness. Right? So how does attraction work in terms of electrical charge? Opposites attract or the same attract? Opposites attract, right? Because a positive will neutralize a negative to be neutral, and that's a very stable form. So if we have a sodium ion right here and put it in water, will sodium dissolve in water? Yes, and a good reason is that you should know why. Why does sodium ion, okay, dissolve in water? Because it is a cation, and as a matter of fact, you should tell me what kind of cation is it? I like it. I heard monovalent cation because it has transferred one electron over here to chlorine. So what kind of ion is chlorine? It's an anion, but what kind of anion? Monovalent anion. Yeah, exactly right. Okay. So this chlorine can dissolve in water as well because it's going to be attracted to the positive end of a water molecule. So things can be hydrophobic or hydrophilic depending on whether they have polarity or not, or if they have electrical charge. So molecules that dissolve in water because they have an electrical charge or are polar, we call those hydrophilic molecules. Right? What does philic mean? Love. Yeah, they love water. And tell me something about a hydrophobic molecule. Nonpolar. And what about with regard to water? Hydrophobic. Yeah, it doesn't like water, won't dissolve in water, like oils, fats, lipids, things like that. Okay. All right, so I think I'm done kind of reviewing here just a little bit. And so I'm going to go to something that looks like this. All right, so, oh, the very next slide, difference between hydrophilic and hydrophobic molecules. And we can break your body down in these two different domains. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of chemists that break the whole planet down into these two different domains. And we know a lot about how chemicals behave depending on whether they're hydrophilic or hydrophobic. We can tell where they end up in the atmosphere, where they end up in the ground. And the same thing for your body. We're going to understand a lot about how your body functions because of that. All right, so here I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 water molecules, right? H2O. And this shows the polarity very nicely, where we have the positive end by the hydrogens, the negative end by that oxygen. And because all these water molecules are polar, they will associate with each other. And here is a bond, an association between the hydrogen end of one water molecule and the oxygen end of another water molecule, and that forms a bond, a very, very weak chemical bond, and we call that a hydrogen bond. So there is a lot of bonding in water, even though it's a liquid. As a matter of fact, you could even almost think of water as a liquid crystal. It is a liquid, but it has a lot of structure. It's almost like a crystal because of these kinds of bonds, which we call, what are these bonds?
Hydrogen
bonds. Okay, and these hydrogen bonds are weak. They're much weaker than covalent and ionic bonds. So if we're going to list bonds in terms of their strength, we would say covalent, ionic, and hydrogen bonds in terms of strength. And then there's only one more that we're going to talk about a little bit later. And I'll mention it a couple times because sometimes students miss this. The fourth kind of association or bond we're going to look at is what we call a van der Waals force. Van der Waals force, three words, V-A-N-D-E-R, and then Waals is W-A-A-L-S. That's on one of the slides coming up. All right, so since these water molecules are attracted to each other, sometimes it's hard to separate them. As a matter of fact, there's some animals that can actually walk on water. They're not heavy enough to separate these bonds, and so they don't go kaplunk. We would go kaplunk, of course. So what kind of animal am I thinking of? Yeah, like insects that are very light, like a mosquito, spiders, things of that nature. All right. And that feature of water where they form all these hydrogen bonds so that the surface of water kind of sticks together, we call that surface tension. And sometimes we want a lot of surface tension in our body. Sometimes we need to defeat that. We don't want these water molecules sticking together, because water acts like a glue. So sometimes we need a glue in our body, and other places we don't want a glue because we want things to move or expand. We don't want them to stick together. So surface tension is an important thing. All right, acids, bases, and the pH scale. Going to have to look at this unless you're familiar with the pH scale. Can anybody see what I'm writing on the board right here? Let's just say that this is a proton. But you know what? I can turn this light on really quick. Yes, I can. Okay, it takes a second. All right, so here is a proton right here. Where did we say these protons are? Nucleus. And then here is a shell. Here's an electron right here in the shell. And, of course, this has a positive charge. This has a negative charge, right? They cancel out. They're not the same size, but they're exactly opposite in charge. Right? And so what element is this? Oh, I took your periodic table away from you. That was nasty, but you know this. This is hydrogen. So what do we call this thing if we take this electron away? Okay. We could call this a proton. Right, this is just a proton. It doesn't have an electron. Or we could say it's a hydrogen ion. And why do we say that's an ion? It has a positive charge, right? So hydrogen ion is a monovalent cation. And we can use these terms synonymous, and I might even use these two terms in the same sentence, but they're all referring to the same thing. Proton, hydrogen ion, the same. And now you kind of see where it comes from. All right, so we can look at some definitions now. An acid is some kind of chemical that releases protons into a water solution. Or you could say acids are something that release what kind of ion? Hydrogen ion into solution. These things are very reactive. They change the chemistry of that water solution drastically. Even small changes in the concentration of this hydrogen ion changes the chemistry drastically. Okay, so an acid We can also think of it as a proton donor, right? Because it's giving up a proton to the solution, or maybe it's giving up a proton to another molecule. A base, on the other hand, is something that does the opposite thing. It lowers the concentration of hydrogen ion or protons in a solution. It's a proton acceptor, right? So if we put an acid in with a base, the acid likes to release that proton, but the base likes to accept it, right? So then an acid and a base will neutralize each other. The proton concentration won't change. Any questions on that? Proton, hydrogen ion? Okay. Haven't talked about pH yet. But here is a compound, HCl. When we put this in water, this H dissociates from the chlorine, right? And that electron from hydrogen ends up on chlorine, so it becomes a monovalent anion. And this H over here just becomes a hydrogen ion, right? So here's a compound that has put hydrogen ions into solution. So what kind of compound would this be? Would this be an acid or a base? Acid, because it what? It releases protons into solution. Here are some other really important acids. Phosphoric acid is very important in our body. Here are some of the protons that can be released into solution. Sometimes it's more than one, because we see that the formula is how many protons in phosphoric acid?
Three.
Yeah, so it can dissociate three times. Nitric acid, that's a very powerful acid. Sulfuric acid, we're not so interested in that in biology, right? But carbonic acid, H2CO3, is something that's very important in our body, and we'll look at that over and over and over again. So what's the chemical formula for carbonic acid? How many hydrogens?
Two.
Two. And then what's a C?
Carbon.
Carbon. And then?
Oxygen.
Yeah, oxygen. And how many oxygens?
Three.
Three. So by the time you're done with this class, this is going to be an important formula for you to know. So H2CO3. That's carbonic acid, and we're producing that all the time. And you know it's an acid because it releases these hydrogens. All right, what about sodium hydroxide, right? Na is sodium. This is the hydroxide anion. We can put a proton together with this OH group, and then what would we have? We would have water. All right, so this sodium hydroxide doesn't donate hydrogens into solution. What does it donate? It donates this OH group. And when it does, remember, what happens to sodium when it dissociates from chlorine? It becomes a cation, and chlorine becomes an anion. So this hydroxide group right here is an anion, just like chloride would be. So this group would be negative. And if there are hydrogen ions in solution, then a hydrogen ion will combine with this OH group to form water under certain circumstances, right? And then the base, which is this thing here, will neutralize the acid. And when a base neutralizes an acid, what molecule do we get? Okay. We get water. Yeah, we get water and a salt, but water is what I was thinking of. All right, so here's another compound, KOH. Would this be a pretty good example of an acid or a base?
Base,
because it donates this hydroxide anion to solution. Not a proton, but this hydroxide. All right, calcium hydroxide has two of these groups that can donate into solution, which will neutralize acids, right? And ammonium hydroxide, none of these are important for our particular class, but at least you get the idea of the difference between an acid and a base. All right, so we need to talk about the concentration of protons in solution or hydrogen ions in solution. And there is something, there's a scale that's very handy to use. We call that the pH scale. And that's just a nice, very formal chemical equation that we use in chemistry in a lot of different ways, right? And here is the equation. pH is equal to the log, and this is the base 10. Some people might be familiar with the log of E, right? But this is the base 10 of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. And you see these brackets right here? Right? These brackets represent the concentration of. So when you see these brackets, whatever inside, we're interested in the concentration of that particular molecule. All right, so if we want to calculate the pH and I give you the concentration, you just take the concentration, put it in your calculator, take the inverse of it, and then take the log base 10, and that will tell you what the pH is. Right, because the concentration can vary from 10 to the minus 0 to 10 to the minus 14th, which means how many decimal places? 14 decimal places. So you'd be really bored writing out all of these decimal places So this equation you're going to find really, really handy because it will condense all those 14 decimal places into a number that just has three decimal places. But it will contain exactly the same information. All right, so it goes from 0 to 14. What's the number right in the middle in the scale of 0 to 14? 7. All right, so a pH of 7 has equal concentrations of hydrogen ions and hydroxide anions. Equal concentrations. And as a matter of fact, it's 10 to the minus 7. If the pH goes less than 7, then the solution becomes more acidic. If the pH goes greater than 7, the solution then becomes basic. And the bigger the number gets, then the more basic it is. Right, from 7 down to 0, below 7 is acidic. The smaller the number is, means it is more acidic. So that's something strange about the pH equation that you'll be familiar with. Right? And that is, as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, right, as hydrogen ion increases, what happens to the pH number? It goes down. It goes the opposite way. It's inversely related because we see that relationship right here. Right? That's the inverse relationship of hydrogen ion concentration to pH. All right, so that's really tricky. You might even want to use your hands, just like I do. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to pH? It decreases, right? So which solution is more acidic, a pH of 3 or a pH of 1? pH of 1 is a lot more acidic. Okay. All right, so that's something about pH, which you have to become a little bit familiar with. It's a little bit strange. So here is the concentration of hydrogen ions. And this first column, in the third column, here is the concentration of hydroxide anions. And in the middle, this is what shows us what the pH is, if we were to put it into that pH equation. And of course, on a test, you'll have to calculate pH, right, or something using that equation. So make sure that you have a basic scientific non-graphing calculator. And you got to know where that log button is. Maybe it's really helpful to know where that inverse button is so that you can calculate the inverse of a concentration and then the log button to tell you what the pH is. All right, so what did we say about pH 7?
Neutral.
Absolutely neutral. So here's pH 7. What's the concentration of hydroxide anions? 10 to the minus 7 molar. And what's the concentration of hydrogen ions? 10 to the minus 7, right? And so they're exactly equal, right? So this is what we call a neutral solution. And there's absolutely no magic and there's no luck involved in being pH 7 relating to this exponent here in scientific notation. They're directly related, right? Okay. And as the concentration increases in hydrogen ions from 10 to the minus 7, minus 6, minus 5, right, then minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, this is becoming more concentrated in hydrogen ions, which means what? More acidic, much more acidic. But that also means what happens to pH? It goes down. All right, so that is strange. Remember, something becomes more acidic, the pH number goes down. And the chemistry is going to change drastically. Well, we don't want our pH to change drastically in our body, just like we don't want our temperature to change drastically. We don't want our blood pressure to change drastically. We want to maintain what? What do we want to maintain in our bodies to stay healthy? Homeostasis, right. So there are homeostatic controls that maintain your pH in your body from about 7.35 to 7.45. So what is your body? Is it absolutely neutral or is it a little bit acidic or a little bit basic? 7.35. Numbers greater than 7, so it's a little bit basic. It's almost neutral, but not quite. Really, really close to neutral. Okay, we drink stuff that is highly acidic. And maybe go to 7-Eleven, get a big 500-ounce glass of Coca-Cola. It has a pH maybe around 2, and we drink all of that acid, all right, and I'm just amazed that we just don't keel over, because if the pH of our body were to change from 7.35 maybe to 7.25, all of a sudden, that would be fatal. All right, does that seem like much of a change for you, 7.35 to 2.5? To me, it kind of seems like, well, it would be insignificant, hard to measure, right? But that's how much our physiology would change. Right? Maybe over a long time we could adjust, but in a short time, that would be fatal. So how does our body maintain pH within a range that's suitable to support life, to maintain homeostasis? Because our body has a chemical compound, or numerous ones, that are called buffers. Buffers are compounds that can absorb protons that are added to a solution, and it can even absorb hydroxide anions. So if you put an acid in solution that has a buffer, the pH does not change. Those protons get absorbed by a buffer. If you put a base in a solution that has a buffer, again, the pH won't change because those buffers will absorb those hydroxide anions. Right. So the important concept here is that a buffer doesn't make a solution go to neutrality, to pH 7. It will just maintain the pH of whatever that buffer is designed to do. So it can maintain a pH that's 8. It can maintain a pH that's 5. That so happens in our body, these buffers maintain a pH of 7.35 to 7.45, something of that nature. All right. One important buffer system in our body is the bicarbonate buffer system. We looked at this molecule right here just a couple of seconds ago, H2CO3. What is that thing? Is it an acid or a base? I see these protons right here, so you should have a sense, it's probably an acid. And go back and look it up. What is it? It is carbonic acid. That's carbonic acid. All right, so how does our body produce carbonic acid? Well, we all have water, right? We're just a solution of water inside of our bodies. And through the process of generating energy via mitochondria, they produce carbon, what?
Dioxide.
Carbon dioxide. Yeah, carbon dioxide. Okay, when I typed this up, I made a mistake because it looks like I put a zero there. That's not a zero. That should really be an O. Yeah, H2O, CO2. But I don't want to go back and change the slide. So our cells produce CO2, and since there's plenty of water around, these two chemical compounds can combine to form carbonic acid. Right? There's a special enzyme that allows this to happen, and once carbonic acid is formed, look what happens. They can dissociate into hydrogen ions and the bicarbonate anion. And this system right here buffers pH because this reaction can go either way. Right? Because what can you tell me about this arrow right here? Is it single-ended or double-ended? It's double-ended, right? So it can go in either direction. It doesn't require energy to do so. So if your body produces a lot of CO2, then that's going to force the reaction to the right. If we lose a lot of CO2 by breathing, it's going to force the reaction to the left. So if we hyperventilate and get rid of a lot of CO2 when we hyperventilate, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration in our body? Okay. If we get rid of this, which way is the reaction going to go? It's going to go to the left. Right? And so when we hyperventilate, that's one way of getting acid out of our body, by getting rid of CO2. So we just actually breathe acid, in a sense, right out of our body. And when the pH of our body changes, our respiration rate changes to help maintain pH homeostasis as a result of the bicarbonate buffer system. There are other important buffer systems, like a phosphate buffer is real important. All right, so that is really good example of a buffer. All right, so here's the normal pH range, which we were talking about. If your body becomes acidic, what has to happen to pH? What happens to this pH number during an acidosis? That's when your body becomes more acidic. What happens to the pH number? It goes smaller than 7.35. If you become alkalotic, right, then what happens to that pH number? Greater than 7.45, right? Your body is getting more and more basic. So that's some of the important groundwork for chemistry. Let's talk about some important organic molecules. And I want to give you a nice strict definition of what an organic molecule is. Right? It's a molecule. Well, I tell you what, I don't even know if we talked about what a molecule is. Does anybody remember if we talked about a molecule? What's a molecule? I don't think I talked about it. Well, that would be unfair. That would be nasty for me to talk about molecules and you don't know what they are. Well, you know what an atom is, right? You got a periodic table with all those different elements. We take one of those things, that is an atom. How many atoms of hydrogen does water have?
Two.
How many atoms of oxygen does water have? What is it? H2, two hydrogens, H2O, and O has just one atom. Okay? And when you put a number of atoms together, it could be just two atoms. Water has three atoms. We call that a molecule. Right? So a molecule is made up of atoms. And so an organic molecule has to have at least two different kinds of atoms joined together by different kinds of bonds. And in particular, here is the definition. It has to have at least one carbon atom and one hydrogen atom. So what would be the symbol for this particular compound? It just would be C and H. No ones, no twos, no nothing. It doesn't really exist like that, but in our mind we can create that molecule. And what can you tell me about that bond between carbon and hydrogen in an organic molecule? It's got to be a covalent. Yeah, it's got to be a covalent bond, which is what kind of bond?
Strong.
And is it polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
Okay. What makes a polar bond? Oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, and nitrogen. Right, so oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, and phosphorus. What about carbon? Nope. It makes a nonpolar covalent bond. So these organic molecules, since they make all these nonpolar covalent bonds, are they polar or are they nonpolar? They're nonpolar. Most organic molecules, unless something fancy is happening, something changes them into a magic molecule, which we're going to see in just a second, they are nonpolar. And if they're nonpolar, do organic compounds like to dissolve in water? No, they hate water. They don't want to have anything to do with water, like fats, oils, gasoline, things like that. All right. It just so happens if we draw out that carbon, that carbon atom and fill up the shells, first two electrons in the first, and then fill up the outer shell with the rest, we're going to see that there's room for four additional electrons in that valence shell because carbon has six protons inside the nucleus, which means it has six electrons, which means two go into the first shell, four go into the second shell, which means there's four spots left over for electrons in that valence shell. So it's going to bind covalently to fill that outer shell so that it has a full complement of eight electrons. So how can that happen? Here we have a carbon atom, right? And it has a nice covalent bond to this hydrogen, a nice covalent bond. That single line right there represents two electrons. Two electrons, right, in a covalent bond is just represented by this solid line. That's just some standard nomenclature. All right, so here, these are all nonpolar covalent bonds. Remember, because it's not phosphorus, nitrogen, sulfur, or oxygen, right, carbon. So here we have a molecule with six carbons on there, and there's all hydrogens. Would this be an example of a organic molecule? Yeah, because here is that covalent bond, a hydrogen bound to a carbon atom. This molecule is not important biologically, right, and that's actually quite poisonous, but nonetheless, this is an organic molecule. We're not so interested in organic chemistry or organic molecules, but it forms kind of the background, the basis of what we're going to look at. We're also interested in some compounds, for instance, like, who can see this? What did I write there on the board? Okay, I'll give you a little bit of a light. Okay. What's this thing right here?
Carbon dioxide.
Yeah, previous slide showed that. So this is a very important biological molecule. Our bodies produce it, thank goodness. We exhale it out of our bodies. Now, is this an organic molecule? And somebody said no, and you're right. Woo-hoo. Why is it not an organic? Because to be an organic, it has to be carbon and a hydrogen. No hydrogen here. Right, so there's a big difference between important biological molecules and organic, but we're going to start with organic molecules. Okay, this big long backbone of carbon, this is only contains carbons and hydrogen. We call this a hydrocarbon, and it is nonpolar, does not like to dissolve in water. It can bend back and fold upon itself and form a ring. Right, so here is cyclohexane. And then sometimes there can be, and I see one line here that represents one covalent bond, but you also see right here, how many lines do you see right in this region?
Two.
Yeah, so that's what we call a double bond. If there are double bonds, it doesn't have as many protons surrounding it. That is what we call benzene. Okay. All right. So these molecules can change depending on the bond structure between these carbons, and maybe we want to take this hydrogen off and put some other kind of atom right there. That's what we're going to call a functional group. Functional groups can be added to this hydrocarbon backbone, and we're going to change the structure of that molecule. Which means what? That's where we get into physiology, right? Because we change the structure of a molecule, we're going to change how it functions inside your body. Okay. And the function changes depending on what functional group is added to that hydrocarbon backbone. All right. So here are a number of functional groups. I see six functional groups in this diagram. Do you see the hydrocarbon backbone? Indeed, you do. This one right here is what we call a carbonyl group, a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. That's carbonyl. Hydroxyl, instead of an oxygen, it's an OH. You're kind of familiar with that hydroxyl group already because it can come from water or can neutralize a proton to form water. Here's a sulfhydryl group. Here is an amino group. Whatever we see on the end of a molecule, a COH, right? CO2H, here's an O, that's two oxygens and a hydrogen, right? So we're changing the structure. Now this thing becomes an acid because this hydrogen right here can jump off the molecule. This molecule can donate that hydrogen to solution. And what kind of compound is a compound that can donate a hydrogen ion to solution? What do we call that? An acid, right? So this is what we call a carboxyl group, but it's an acid. And sometimes, hopefully you looked at your periodic table. What's this F, this P stand for?
Phosphorus.
So the hydrocarbon backbone can be modified with a phosphorus group right here. And you can see a proton here and a proton here. So this phosphate group can actually donate two hydrogens into solution. So this is sort of acidic as well. But these are what we call organic acids. Right, here's an example of an organic alcohol. And here are some other kinds of compounds like amino. Have you ever run into a molecule that has amino in it?
Protein.
Yeah, like a protein. Because what is a protein made out of? Amino acid. So an amino acid has something that looks like this and something that looks like that combined together. So we call that an amino acid. All right, so for the test, I do want you to be able to recognize these different functional groups by name. Right, so I give you a picture, but I have a way that you can learn these pretty easily. All right, so we're going to start with this hydrocarbon backbone. We're going to change its structure by adding some functional groups to it. So what's the functional group that we add to this molecule right here? What's the functional group? Yeah, this OH group. There's one, two, three, four, five, right? Different OH groups. All right, and this is what we call a carbohydrate. These are examples of simple sugars or monosaccharides. And so I do want you to be able to, when you see this illustration on a test, or this one, or this one, or this one, and this one, you should be able to tell me that that is a monosaccharide or a simple sugar. And what can you tell me about sugar? Does it dissolve in water? Yeah, it's polar. What about this molecule here allows it to dissolve in water? Where does it get its polarity from? I see this big hydrocarbon backbone that makes it nonpolar. Where does its polarity come from so it can dissolve in water? Look at these OH groups. What kind of bond is oxygen bound to hydrogen? What kind of bond is that? Yes, it is a covalent bond, not quite hydrogen, it's a covalent bond. Two kinds of covalent bonds, polar or nonpolar. It's polar. Remember, oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus make polar covalent bonds. So all of these bonds right here are polar, which means that this monosaccharide loves to dissolve in water because of all that polarity. Okay. All right, so these are examples of monosaccharides, simple sugars. And here are some examples, glucose, galactose, fructose. You know, if I give you this figure on an exam, you should just tell me that's a monosaccharide or simple sugar. You don't have to tell me that's glucose. You don't have to tell me that's galactose, but you do have to tell me that that's a monosaccharide, right? Don't have to tell me this is fructose, but you have to tell me that this thing here is what? An example of a monosaccharide. And it just so happens we can put monosaccharides together to make what we call a disaccharide, which is probably on the next slide. Well, why do we call all these things carbohydrates? Well, it's because when somebody first started out looking at these sugars and they broke the molecule apart, for every carbon atom, guess what they found? An H1, H2, and an O. What's H2O?
Water.
So they call this a carbon hydrate, and for short, we call it a carbohydrate as a result of that. Okay. All right, so you see these functional groups that make it a polar compound. All right, should a polar compound have a different function compared to a nonpolar compound, like that hexane we were looking at? Oh, yeah, because one dissolves in water, one doesn't even dissolve in water, right? So it's going to have a much different kind of function. All right, so a disaccharide has two monosaccharides. It could be a glucose-glucose, could be a glucose-galactose, could be a glucose-fructose. Here are some molecules of disaccharides, or examples of disaccharides. And you should probably know what makes up sucrose. Sucrose is table sugar. It has one molecule of glucose and one of fructose. Lactose, or milk sugar, we find this in milk. It has one glucose and one galactose. Right? And maltose, this is a sugar made up of just two glucose molecules joined together. Right, so this is where some of these sugars come from. Well, we can put more than two monosaccharides together, or your body can put more than two. It can put many, many, maybe thousands. Probably not a million, but thousands and thousands. If we put thousands of glucoses together, then we get something that's not a monosaccharide, certainly not a disaccharide. We don't want to count how many glucoses are there, so we just call it a polysaccharide. Poly just means many, many glucoses put together. And when those glucoses are put together, it can be put together in a straight line, or it could be put together in a branched pattern. And starch and glycogen are polymers of glucose. So when we eat starch, what are we really eating? We are eating? Yeah, we're eating, and what's the monosaccharide? Okay, well, sugar could be a whole bunch of compounds. Sugar could be any kind of carbohydrate. But I would like to know the monosaccharide that makes up starch. It says right here, it is glucose. Yeah, it's glucose. So when you eat a starch, it's like eating sugar if someone is a diabetic, for instance. Starch comes from plants, right, like wheat and potatoes, things like that. Bread is starch. Glycogen is that same kind of molecule that animals make, but it has a little bit different branching pattern, so it's not quite the same thing as starch. But glycogen is really made out of what monosaccharide? Glucose. So that's a way that your body stores glucose for when you start to run low. Like, for instance, when you're in a fasted state and your blood glucose level starts to drop, glycogen is broken down by the liver, and that glucose then is released into the blood, maintaining blood glucose homeostasis. All right, so these organisms like us can store thousands of glucoses in one polysaccharide molecule, which drastically reduces osmotic problems, which we're going to get, that's some physical chemistry, which I'm going to have to talk about in a different lecture. All right, so when we talk about osmotic pressure. Okay, so, yeah.
So if we eat, you know, like, if we eat, different
kind
of sugar in one day, so yeah, we will have, you know, like the polysaccharide in our body.
Yeah.
That will automatically come from our body.
Okay. Yeah, when we have a lot of glucose, when blood glucose starts to go up, then the liver is told to take that glucose out of the blood, okay, and make the glycogen out of it. So as blood glucose goes up, liver is told to take it out. What happens to blood glucose then when the liver starts to make glycogen out of it? It goes back down to the set point, maintaining homeostasis. So that's sort of the answer to your question. But if I could understand your question better, I could answer it better. Say it one more time.
No, if you know, like I love to eat sugar.
Yes.
So if I eat so many sugar at one day,
yeah,
I think I will build up a lot of, you know, like polysaccharides. That's what I mean.
Yeah, your body's going to make a lot of polysaccharides. Okay? But only a certain amount. It can get to a high level. And then when you have all those extra glucoses, so your liver is filled up with glycogen, then the fat cells get busy. They say, give me that monosaccharide. I can make a fat out of it. I can make something called a fatty acid. And that's what it does. All right, so in the long term, when you're starving, when you're running out of glucose, no, you can't change a fatty acid into glucose. It can only go the other way. So when we're done with respiration, all right, chapter, you'll see why that happens. All right. So glucose, your body can make fat out of glucose, but your body can't make glucose out of fat. That's one of the reasons, I suppose, why it's so hard to lose fat, because your body kind of stores it. Okay? All right, so that extra glucose that you eat goes into fat. All right, so you might be interested, we talked about disaccharides. How does that happen? Well, here's a really easy way. This is a real easy slide to understand. Here I see a monosaccharide, right, glucose, and another one, two separate molecules. And here are the functional groups, right, an H and an OH. When they join together just in the right way, one of these glucoses will lose a hydrogen, the other one a hydroxyl group, right? And then what is made? A water molecule. Then a chemical bond is made between these two ring structures. And here is an example of glucose and glucose bound together, which is maltose. But there's one other thing. What else was produced? A water molecule. And this is really kind of handy because water is the solvent that our body is dissolved in. That's just a magical, interesting thing about water. It participates in a lot of chemical reactions in our body, but it's also the solvent that we're dissolved in. All right, so this is what we call a dehydration or condensation reaction. Dehydration because water is taken out of these compounds, right, and put into solution. We can take a glucose and a fructose, same kind of reaction, right? It's going to take this water out from these two different molecules. And so we have a glucose and a fructose, that's table sugar. What kind of reaction is the production of sucrose from glucose and fructose?
Water.
What do we call that? That is a dehydration reaction or condensation, right? Okay. So anytime we put two molecules together and water comes out of it, we call that a dehydration or condensation reaction. And you might even want to say dehydration synthesis reaction because a disaccharide is being synthesized as a result of that. Okay. The opposite can take place. I wish I had a double-ended arrow right here because, for instance, maybe let's just say instead of just maltose, maybe we have thousands of glucoses put together to form. Instead of just two glucose, we have thousands put together. What do we have inside our bodies? Glycogen, right? So think of this as maybe a glycogen molecule. I'm only drawing out two, right? And you're in a fasted state, so your blood glucose levels start to decrease. Then the liver is going to take a water molecule, split it in half, use those two compounds to break this bond to form two glucoses, right? So here's one proton, here's a hydroxyl group. These are two monosaccharides now floating in solution, and so that increases blood glucose concentration. This is what we call a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis because what molecule has to be broken apart before these monosaccharides, before this disaccharide can be broken into two monosaccharides?
Water.
Hydrolysis, yeah. What does lysis mean? Separation, like a lysosome breaks things up, right? Hemolysis, heme means blood. Hemolysis means the breakdown of blood, right? Hydrolysis is the breakdown of water used to separate big polymers into their basic building blocks. For instance, here would be two glucoses. This arrow could go backwards for sucrose as well, right? So if we have sucrose, our body can break it down to fructose and glucose using what kind of reaction? Okay, what kind of reaction is your body going to use to break sucrose down into two monosaccharides? That is a hydrolysis reaction, which is the opposite of a dehydration synthesis or condensation reaction. All of these are a result of water. Okay, lipids. You know, before I started talking about carbohydrates, I should have said there are four important kinds of biological molecules that we're going to look at in this class. One is carbohydrate. Take a guess at what the other three might be. Lipids is two. Yeah, because I showed you that slide. That's coming up, lipid. Totally different than carbohydrate. What else? Protein. Okay. And what's the fourth one? Fourth one. Okay, lipid and fat is the same thing. We're going to look at, if you look forward in your notes, you're going to see nucleic acids. Nucleic acids build chromosomes, build DNA, that's genetic material. All right, so let's move from carbohydrates or carbon hydrates to lipids. All right, lipids are fats. They're insoluble in polar solvents, such as water. I should have asked you, what kind of solvent is water? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar, right? Okay. So lipids are hydrophobic. They don't want to have anything to do with water because they have a bunch of nonpolar covalent bonds. They're just basically hydrocarbon chains or rings. So here is a long chain of carbon and hydrogen. So this is the hydrocarbon chain. This is absolutely nonpolar. It won't dissolve in water. Ah, but can anybody remember what this thing is over here? Yeah, that's the acid group. CO2H, that makes this molecule acid. So this is the fatty part. Here's the acid part. So we're going to call this thing a fatty acid because it's fatty and it's an acid, right, when we see this thing. That makes this compound relatively reactive because this proton can be donated to solution. And so these things are slightly soluble in water, slightly soluble, but not all that soluble because of this long hydrocarbon chain. And how many fatty acids do you see in this column? I see three. Here is another compound. If we break glucose in half, glucose has six carbons. We break glucose in half, we can end up with this molecule sometimes, right? And this is called glycerol. And glycerol has three functional groups, one on each carbon, a hydroxyl group. And so that can bind with, this hydroxyl group can combine with the proton on the carbonic acid, forming a covalent bond, and you're going to end up with this thing over here, one glycerol and three fatty acids, and you're all familiar with this. I'm sure you've all had a blood test measuring these things. These things are what we call triglycerides, right, because it has three fatty acids and a glycerol put together. What kind of reaction did your body use to make a triglyceride? Condensation or dehydration synthesis reaction, just like for those monosaccharides. Your body didn't have to invent anything new. Same reaction. Right? You're going to notice that if something works, right, your body doesn't have to invent something new and different. It's the same thing over and over again. Right? So dehydration synthesis means that for every fatty acid joined to glycerol, you get a water molecule. And since there are three fatty acids, you get three water molecules. Now, can your body break a triglyceride down? With what kind of reaction? A hydrolysis reaction, right? It's going to break three water molecules. It's going to break that bond. You're going to end up with glycerol and three fatty acids, just like that. So this reaction can go backwards and forwards depending on the energy state of your body. Here is another compound. I see this really big, long hydrocarbon chain. Is this polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
Okay, I heard polar. I'm still thinking I'm polar. What do you need to be polar? You need oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, or sulfur. Okay. So do you see oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, or sulfur on anywhere in here?
No.
No. So that can't be polar. It's got to be nonpolar. Here's the nonpolar group. That doesn't dissolve in water. This thing is what we call a fatty acid, right? CO2H, that's the acidic group. This one right here is palmitic acid. This is a saturated fatty acid. Right? So I do want you to know this is a fatty acid, but what kind? You don't have to tell me the name. Right? But if there's a double, if there are no double bonds between the carbons, that means for every carbon there are at least two hydrogens, we say it's completely saturated with hydrogen atoms. So this is what we call a saturated fatty acid. Right. Here is an unsaturated fatty acid because this carbon and this carbon here share a double bond, and so this carbon doesn't have that second hydrogen. This carbon here doesn't have that second hydrogen. This is what we call an unsaturated fatty acid. All right, these saturated fatty acids, these are like the worst things you can eat, like in steak, hamburgers, bacon, stuff like that. Wonderful, tastes wonderful, but in the long run, very deadly because it produces cardiovascular disease. So the structure changes. Guess what? The function drastically changes in how you metabolize these things and what happens to your body over time. Okay, so what I want you to know, tell me the difference between a saturated and an unsaturated fatty acid. You don't have to tell me the specific name. Okay, unsaturated is double bond. Saturated, only one bond between carbons. All right, let's pay attention to this part of the molecule right here. I see 1, 2, 3 carbons. All right, what did we see that had 3 carbons, a half of a glucose molecule before? What was this? 1, 2, 3, that's A? Okay, but in particular, just this part is a glycerol molecule, which can make a triglyceride. So if we look here, here is the glycerol part, and here are 2 fatty acids, so this is almost like a diglyceride, right? But on this third carbon, there's something fascinating taking place right here. I see this is a phosphatidyl group. You just have to be able to see that here is a phosphorus, right? Here is a nitrogen group, right? So this end of the molecule, because of this hydrocarbon chain, is this polar or nonpolar? Nonpolar. Does it like to dissolve in water?
No.
No. What about this end of the molecule over here, because it has a phosphorus and a nitrogen? Yes, this is a polar end, right? Plus, I also see some charges. Anything that's an ion likes to dissolve in water. So what can you tell me about this little beast right here? Does it like to dissolve in water or fat in your body? Well, we might have to analyze this a little bit further. This right here is what we call the head group of this phospholipid, right? So here is a triglyceride that's been modified. This phosphate and nitrogen group have been added to it. This is the head group, which is this part, and these are what we call tails. The tails are hydrophobic. The head is hydrophilic. So here is a phospholipid, kind of a magical molecule. Let me draw some stuff on the board. Oh, it takes a while for them to turn on. Okay. So let's erase this right here. And, okay, in your refrigerator at home, you have this fancy bottle like that. Okay, and what kind of bottle is that? It's in your refrigerator. It's a salad dressing bottle. Okay, salad dressing. And if you look at this salad dressing bottle, you're going to notice that there are 2 regions, right? There's going to be a region on top and a region on the bottom. So when you put the salad, did you have to do anything to get this separation? Usually it takes some kind of energy or some kind of mechanism to separate things out, right? Like if I'm going to separate you into 2 groups, somebody's got to get up and move. That's going to take energy. But what did you do? How did you separate that out? I'm curious. You put it in the refrigerator, or you could even leave it on the table. Does that happen automatically? Or did you have to do something? Did you get in a tweezer and move molecules around? Does that happen automatically? As a matter of fact, it does, right? Okay, and if you want to eat this salad dressing, put it on your salad, would you just pour it onto your salad? Because what's in this top layer? Oil, right? Oil. And down over here would be the water part. Remember, water doesn't mix with oil. And this is where all the tasty stuff is, spices, salt and stuff like that dissolve in water. And oil, just, I don't know why it's in there, because it's fun to eat fat, I guess, okay? All right, so what do you have to do before you eat this salad dressing? Shake it up. You got to mix it all together. And then if you leave it on the table long enough, what's going to happen? By magic, it's just going to separate right out again, okay? So here is, what is this molecule here? Kind of like a cell, but it's a molecule, not a cell. A molecule is a building block of an organelle, organelle building block of cell. Okay, so what is this thing? Here's a head group, here are tails. This is a phospholipid. Yeah, it's on that slide right there, phospholipid. So let's take a phospholipid molecule and drop it in here. It's going to go kaplunk into the oil. And what's going to happen to that phospholipid? Is it going to just stay there right on the surface? Is it going to sink to the bottom? They're going to swim around, or what's it going to do? Okay. This loves water, hydrophilic. This loves oil, just like that. So if we wait a certain period of time, the tails are going to end up in the water. The other way. The head is going to end up in the water and the tails are going to stick up in the oil because that's their basic nature. Just by magic, we don't have to worry about anything. It will just automatically do that. But instead of one molecule, let's put thousands of these. What are these again? Phospholipids. Let's put thousands in the bottle. What's going to happen? They're all going to line up just like this, right, with these tails running up, running up, running up, running up. Okay. And does it take anything special to produce this structure in the salad dressing bottle? Nothing special. And this should remind you of something from anatomy. That is a layer of phospholipid. It kind of looks like a membrane. Okay? Yeah, it kind of looks like a cell membrane. So membranes have the ability to do what? Self-assemble. They build themselves just because of the characteristic of that molecule. So phospholipid is really special because it has that polar and nonpolar nature to it. And it can just automatically form membranes. And a membrane, remember, is a really important building block of a cell, which means it's an important building block of life. Yeah, in order to be alive, you have to be made out of cells. So this is an important structure for you to become familiar with. This phosphorus and nitrogen make it a polar. These fatty acids over here make it nonpolar. We put it in water, right? Not a salad dressing bottle, but just plain old water. Then all of these hydrophobic tails will join together, right? And the hydrophilic head group will be associated with water. And this thing right here is what we call a micelle, but not just in two dimensions. It's going to be a sphere in water. And so now, not only do we have a membrane, but what do we have? We have a micelle, which kind of looks like a cell already, right? So cells have some ability to self-assemble themselves. These phospholipids, sometimes we put them in our bodies in smaller concentration. They act as surfactants because they can break up the association between different water molecules. They can make water slippery instead of more like a glue. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So phospholipids, really important kind of lipid in our body. All right, so make sure you can recognize that structure. Here's another kind of structure. These are all hydrocarbons. Whenever we have a little joint right here between two straight lines, that represents a carbon atom with two hydrogens, and then here is a bond to the next carbon over here. So this is a hydrocarbon, and I don't see any nitrogen or phosphorus here, so this, is this polar or nonpolar? Nonpolar. Does it like to dissolve in fat or water? In fat, yeah. And this particular molecule is what we call cholesterol. And so you see this like a staircase shape right here. You could step up to here and then step up to here and then step up to here. If you ever see this kind of structure, I want you to know this as a steroid. Right? And here are some steroids. Hydrocortisone, testosterone, estrogen. Some are sex steroids. Right, some have to do with glucose regulation. This would be a glucocorticoid, but these are all steroids. They are built from cholesterol. So now what can you tell me about cholesterol? Is it a good molecule or bad molecule in your body? Bad. Yeah, because cholesterol can plug up arteries. It can cause cardiovascular disease. So should we get rid of all cholesterol in our body? The answer would be no, because then you couldn't make hydrocortisone, you couldn't make testosterone, you couldn't make estradiol, right? So these are important sex steroids, and even women produce testosterone, right? And I don't know anybody that would want to give up the production of estrogen and testosterone in our body. So some cholesterol is absolutely necessary. All right, so if I show you anything that has this like step look to it with all these rings, you're going to say steroid as opposed to fatty acid. All right, remember what a fatty acid looks like? Ah, here's a fatty acid. Sometimes your body makes a bend, 180-degree bend to it, and we end up with another important kind of compound called a prostaglandin. Here's that carboxyl group. Here are a couple other functional groups. depending on where these functional groups go, changes the structure, changes the function. So these are all different kinds of prostaglandins, and these are important signaling compounds in your body. All right, but in order to be a signaling compound, when this prostaglandin E1 bumps into a cell, in order for the cell to know that prostaglandin E1 is there, what does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor, right, based on the shape, right? And a receptor for F1 is going to be different. Receptor for E2 is going to be different. But these are all prostaglandins, and you can see what's the building block of a prostaglandin? It is a fatty acid, right? Here's the fatty end, here's that acid part. Okay, so that's it for lipids. How would you make a triglyceride once again? How would you make a triglyceride? Just a general name of that reaction. It's got four different pieces that you want to join together. And you pull out water when you do. Dehydration synthesis reaction to make a triglyceride. How do you break a triglyceride down? Hydrolysis, yeah, you put water in, you got to break water apart, put it in. Same thing for carbohydrates, same kind of mechanism. Protein, you all know what the building block of protein is. What's a building block? Amino acid, right? So it's an organic compound, but it also has nitrogen, that's the amino part, has that acid part, which is the acid carboxyl group. Okay, and you could tell me how proteins are made. What kind of reaction is used to take two amino acids and put them together? You already know, because we looked at it two times already. Yeah, it takes the water out, makes the water, puts these two amino acids together. That's what we call, what, a dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, but before we get there, here is an example of an amino acid. Here is the central carbon. It has one central carbon. Sometimes we call that the alpha carbon. And on this carbon, we have one group that has a nitrogen, which we call amino group. Here is a CO2H on the other end. That's a carboxyl group. So this is what? An amino acid. And then this other bond coming up over here, R, represents that we can put, or your body puts a whole bunch of different kinds of things there. There's a lot of variability. And so this is the functional group. R just means it could be any number of different kinds of things. It could be another acid group, could be another amino group, could be a sulfur group, could be other kinds of things. All right, here are some examples of amino acids. You don't have to recognize these things, but probably if somebody says tyrosine, you should probably know that's an amino acid. So as an example of what kind of amino acids you can make, here is a hydrocarbon chain. So valine is what? This is a nonpolar group right here. Right. And then here is another nonpolar group. It almost looks like a benzene, right? That's a tyrosine. Your body cannot make tyrosine. Your body can't make valine. Right, so this, since your body cannot make tyrosine, we call that an essential amino acid. So if you're building a protein that needs a tyrosine put together via dehydration synthesis reaction, you have to have tyrosine in your diet or your body can't make that particular protein. Tyrosine also is used to make some neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are chemicals that allow cells to communicate with each other, and without tyrosine in your diet, you can't build those chemicals to help coordinate different cells in your brain and other parts of the nervous system. So these are what we call essential amino acids. A good source of these would be animal protein, for instance. You'll have to talk to me after class if you want to talk about a vegetarian diet or something like that. There's ways you can get by. Here are some polar amino acids. Why is arginine a polar amino acid? Because it has an atom that is bound to a hydrogen. And what makes a polar covalent bond again? Oxygen, phosphorus, nitrous, sulfur, right? And I see nitrogens there. What about this cysteine that has a sulfur group? That is polar, right? And aspartic acid. Okay, it has this acidic group, so that's a very polar group as a result of that. Okay, so amino acids can have different natures depending on how that functional group is substituted. Here we have 1, 2, 3, 4 different amino acids. And these can be put together to make a polypeptide, a very short protein of only 4 amino acids. And how does your body do that? By a dehydration synthesis reaction. Actually, I wanted you to draw this in class this week. I forgot to send it out. All right, maybe next week. I'm going to have you draw this reaction out in lab, just as shown here. Or maybe I'll modify it. I'll have you label what this arrow is. How would you label this arrow? Here's water. Three waters because of these three bonds. Dehydration synthesis reaction. Exactly right. So a peptide bond is made by dehydration synthesis reaction. So this CO group and this NH group, when they're bound together, that makes a peptide bond. That's a covalent bond. And it's given a little special color right here because it's actually a very strong bond for covalent bonds. So proteins are very strong. It takes a really long time in special conditions to hydrolyze a protein because of the nature of this bond right here. This is a very strong bond. This reaction can go in reverse, but you need very strange pH conditions. You need very acidic and then very basic conditions after that and some special enzymes to allow that to degrade. All right, so that's the formation of a peptide bond. If you have a chain of amino acids less than 100, we call that a polypeptide. If it's over 100 amino acids, we call that a protein. That's kind of a loose definition, but that will work in here. So proteins have special structure to it. It has a special folding pattern, and that's determined by that functional group and what's substituted on that functional group. All right, so let's go back to carbohydrates. What's the basic building block of a polysaccharide? Polysaccharide, what do you need to put together? Monosaccharides, right? Monosaccharide building block for polysaccharide. What about a triglyceride? What's the building block of triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. Now you kind of know what the structure of amino acid is, right? So here I see one amino acid joined to a second one, joined to a third one. This is just a linear representation of how these amino acids were put together. Think of this maybe as a word, right? And a word has just certain letters next to each other, just like a protein will have different amino acids put next to each other. If you change the order of letters in a word, you change the spelling, is that important? What does that do to the word? Changes the meaning, right? Change the structure of that word in terms of letters, changes the meaning, right? If you change the order of amino acids in a protein, then you're going to change the function of that particular protein. And so it's important to know what amino acids are next to each other. This is what we call the primary structure of a protein. Just what is the spelling of that protein in terms of amino acids? What amino acid comes next? Which one comes after that? Which one comes after that? That's what we call primary structure. And once the primary structure is determined, then some of these functional groups might like to associate with each other, right? If they're nonpolar, they will like to associate with each other. If they're polar, they like to associate with each other. And since a protein is a really long molecule, it's going to fold back. It's going to twist around, right? And these groups are going to attract each other and promote some kind of bending, right? And here I see a nice spiral pattern, kind of looks like a spiral staircase. This is what we call an alpha helix, and the alpha helix is what we call secondary structure, right? Because I see a whole bunch of amino acids put together. And what's the building block of this secondary structure? Okay. I see some hydrogen bonds between different parts within here. So hydrogen bonds are necessary to form, to stabilize the structure. And what allows these hydrogen bonds to form? Well, the correct amino acid has to be here, and the correct amino acid has to be here in order for that hydrogen bond to take place. All right, so what do we call just a sequence of amino acids in a protein? Just a linear sequence, the spelling of a protein. That is the primary structure. All right, so the primary structure determines the secondary structure. So the building block of secondary structure is primary structure. Right. And there's another one called a beta pleated sheet. So instead of nice curves to it, it looks more like an accordion. Right. It has just jagged shapes. So what's the building block of a beta pleated sheet? It is primary structure. Right. So primary structure determines the secondary structure. And then depending on how many of these spiral regions and beta pleated sheets are in a protein, that will determine the overall structure of that protein. Can you see this alpha helix? What is alpha helix? Primary or secondary structure? That's secondary structure. All right. And then when we look at how this protein folds around, twists around in space, that's what we call tertiary structure. So in order for the proper tertiary structure to form, what does this protein have to have? It has to have the proper secondary structure. Right? So what's the building block of tertiary structure? It is?
Secondary.
What's the building block of secondary? Primary. Right? So the protein has to have the right sequence. It has to have the right primary structure. Then it folds into the proper secondary structure. And then finally, then this protein has a useful shape. Because if the shape changes, what happens? The function is going to change. All right, so tertiary structure is just a three-dimensional shape of this protein. And so you can see proteins are a little bit more complicated than lipids and carbohydrates because we can have all different kinds of shapes, which means we can have all different kinds of proteins. And sometimes within this tertiary structure, we can put some other kind of group. This is a heme group. There's an iron in this particular thing, and that allows this protein to absorb oxygen in our lungs and deliver it to other places in our body. So this is then, if this is going to be the globin protein, and here's a heme group, this would be hemoglobin. Maybe you've heard of hemoglobin. Right? Hemoglobin is found in red blood cells, and it has to have the right shape in order to deliver oxygen to your tissues. Okay? All right, so this is a special heme group. This heme group is an organic compound, and it's really big and cumbersome. I won't ask you to recognize what this thing is, but you should at least know that it has an iron atom in there. All right, these proteins are not very stable. We can change the shape of these things, and when we change the shape of a protein, of course, we change its function. We call that denaturation. And how can we denature a protein? We can do it with heat, we can do it with pH, and in your notes you can even put down salt concentration. Can change the shape of proteins, change the function of proteins. And as a matter of fact, if you take a hamburger tonight and you heat it up, does raw hamburger look like cooked hamburger? No, it doesn't. Because the cooked hamburger has been what? It has been denatured by heat. Right, so none of those proteins in that hamburger, right, have any functional value to anything because they've changed their shape, and it's a way of killing bacteria and preserving that meat as well. Okay. You can act, so with pH, you can change, you can denature proteins like fish, for instance, or meat. How, and so when you denature food that you eat with pH, that's a way of like cooking. Who's ever cooked meat by not heating it, by changing the pH? And what do we call that food? It's a way of preserving it, right? Like ceviche, which is fish. And what pH, what do you put on there? Lemon juice, which is acid, right? And that acid denatures the proteins. And then, well, it's really, really tasty. Salt, you can use salt as well to denature. So you can cook with pH, you can cook with heat, you can cook with acid. Right, to denature proteins, make them easier to eat. All right, what do I have right here? Here is a long string of amino acids, and I see some functional groups. All right, here's a COOH group, a carboxyl group. Here's an amino group. All right, so here is a negative charge, here's a positive charge. So what's going to happen with amino acids with these two different charges right here? Yeah, they're going to attract each other via ionic bond. And is this a strong bond or weak bond?
Stronger.
Sort of strong, but it's weaker than covalent. So this bond can break. All right. And here is where we have two cysteine amino acids, different parts of the protein, and then it can form this disulfide bridge. And here is the sharing of two electrons. So what can you tell me about this bond right here? It's a covalent bond, and you know that to be how strong? The strongest, right? So here's a bond that really holds this protein in a particular conformation or configuration because it's a strong bond. This one, not so much. What about between this group here and this group here? Hydrogen bond, right? And what is that? A really weak bond. So that's why when we heat this molecule up and it starts to jiggle and move around, it's easy to break these bonds, which then is going to change the overall shape of the molecule. These bonds are difficult to break. Furthermore, the weakest one that I told you we were going to look at, here are some nonpolar amino acids. There's one here and there's one here. It just so happens that these functional groups point into the center of the protein. And what can you tell me about nonpolar molecules? Do they associate or do they hate each other? They like each other, right? Polar compounds associate, nonpolar compounds, but they don't cross over. So here are two nonpolar regions, so these areas are going to be attracted to each other. That's going to form a little bit of a bend. We call that a van der Waals force, and that's even much weaker than a hydrogen bond. So this is a very easy bond to break. It will be broken very easily with heat, with acid, with different kinds of salt concentrations, changing the conformation of this protein, right, which changes the function. And what did we call that? What do we call that process when we change the natural or normal shape of a protein? Denaturation, right? And that natural shape is what we call the tertiary structure, right? The tertiary structure. Tertiary structure can change with heat, right, when we denature. All right, one other thing about this denaturation process. I don't have a curve, I don't have a graph. Somewhere a little bit later in the class, I have a graph. So, you know, it just so happened over the weekend. I had a steak and I put it on the barbecue, and what did I do to all those proteins in the steak? Denatured them, right? And then I got a call, some friends called me from the pool hall, and they say, we've got three people, we need a fourth person, come on down and shoot pool. And so what do I say? No, I can't because I just made a steak. Well, of course, I'm going to do something with the steak. I'm not going to eat it. I'm going to go shoot some pool, but I'm going to take the steak and put it in the refrigerator for later. Okay? Does it renature? Does that steak go back to being a raw steak? Do I have to cook it again when I get home? I don't. So denaturation is what we call an irreversible process, right? It cannot reverse itself. It's catastrophic. Right? There's only one example where denaturation can be reversed, and it has to do with these disulfide bonds. If anybody's ever gotten a permanent, right, some beautician has used some strong chemicals to break this disulfide bridge, put your hair in a certain configuration, then use some more chemicals to reform these disulfide bridges, right, so your hair was denatured and then put back, renatured. That's the only example that I know that a protein can be renatured. But think of another example maybe before I see you on Thursday. Okay. All right, so sign the sign-in sheet. It is going around somewhere.